This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, May 10th, 2021, on your public radio station, KUAF. It's National Clean Your Room Day. We are a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. On this Monday, we conclude the podcast series, The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South in Arkansas, in our second half hour. Before that, Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda previews a special election in Lowell. And after Ozarks, on Here and Now, a visit to Skid Row in Los Angeles on the heels of a federal ruling that the city has to house all the people who live there. We'll hear that story and all of the news that we need to know this afternoon on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston, beginning at 1. The Arkansas Department of Health is reporting 95 new cases of COVID-19 in Sunday testing. Active cases yesterday fell by more than 40. Hospitalizations from the virus ticked up by 3 to 166. One more death from the disease was reported. The ADH reports just more than one-third of Arkansans 16 and over are fully immunized, and about another 11% are partially immunized. Variants of the coronavirus that cause COVID-19 are causing concern among some health experts in the state. On Arkansas PBS this week, Dr. Jennifer Dillehay, the director of immunizations for the Arkansas Department of Health, said getting people vaccinated is necessary to stop the virus from mutating.
We have an increasing number of what we call variants of concern circulating in Arkansas. And every time someone gets infected with COVID-19, they assist in the spread and the development of variants.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, existing mutations of COVID-19 have allowed it to become more easily spread and impacted the severity of the disease it causes. The state of Arkansas will pull out of the federal Supplemental Jobless Benefit Program. Governor Asa Hutchinson announced the move on Friday. The governor says the program was created to assist unemployed during the pandemic when businesses were laying off employees and there were too few jobs. Now, he writes, there are still few workers available for jobs available in retail and other sectors. The governor says the $300 a month checks helped thousands make it through a tough time and served a good purpose. But now the state needs people to be back on the job so, as the governor states, the economy can return to full speed. Arkansas's participation ends about 10 weeks before the checks were scheduled to end. The Arkansas Razorback softball team will begin play in the SEC tournament Thursday afternoon against the winner of a game between Tennessee and Texas A&M. Arkansas finished the regular conference season tied with Florida for the best record and enters the tournament as the number 2 seed. Meanwhile, the number 1 Arkansas Razorback baseball team remains at the top of the SEC West after taking 2 of 3 games from Georgia this weekend at Baum Stadium in Fayetteville. Partly cloudy tonight, lows from 46 to 51. There is a 50% chance of rain tomorrow, possibly a thunderstorm tomorrow afternoon, with highs in the lower to mid-60s. This is Ozarks at Large. After canceling because of COVID-19 concerns, an intensive college preparatory program from the Cherokee Nation Foundation returns this year to a virtual platform. Ozarks at Large's Daniel Carruth spoke with the foundation's executive director, Janice Randall, to learn more.
Each summer, Cherokee high school students from across the U.S. gather in Tahlequah, Oklahoma, for the Cherokee College Preparatory Institute.
OCO, I'm Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr., and I couldn't be more pleased that you're here today, carefully considering your plans for the future. The next steps can get overwhelming at times, but we want you to know that there are many resources available to help you succeed.
That's Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. in a promotional video for the new virtual program that is launching this summer. After canceling the College Prep Institute last year due to concerns about COVID-19, the Cherokee Nation Foundation, which runs the institute, developed a virtual curriculum for 2021. Janice Randall, executive director for the foundation, says the pandemic created another barrier for high schoolers hoping to pursue higher education.
You know, they've missed so much. You know, they missed their proms, they missed their graduations last year, and so some of their families were struggling just to keep their job or keep the food on the table, and higher education may have seemed like that just wasn't going to work out for them. And so these students are resilient, like their ancestors, and of course they're going to be searching for answers, and we just hope that we can see them reach their full potential, because we watch them and monitor some of their grades. We have some Cherokee scholars, and they send in their transcripts every year, and we see how they're progressing and how they could be of value once they get a college education. We don't want to see them lose their ambition for that.
So after doing some online ACT training for students in 2020, Randall and other foundation members noticed more students taking advantage of those virtual opportunities.
But one thing about doing it virtually is that we're able to reach more students, because we have students, we're the largest tribe, we have students in all 50 states, and some of them cannot afford to come here on their own money, and so by doing it virtually, they're going to be able to attend. We pay for everything once they get to Tahlequah, but they had in the past had to pay their own transportation. And we've had students from Michigan, from California, from Texas, all over, because this is quite an opportunity for them.
That virtual format includes sessions on the college application process, essay writing, and financial aid led by admissions officers from partnering colleges. New this year is a session with the Indian Health Service on scholarships and tuition assistance. Randall says the online program was developed with help from College Horizons, a nonprofit organization that aims to increase the number of Native students attending universities.
And we've worked really hard this past year to do the virtual format, but they're still not getting the benefit of all the universities that we would have there.
Another part of the week-long camp that students are missing out on is the experience of living in a dorm and meeting other students from across the country. And she says, while the Institute is designed to give Cherokee students more access to college resources, it's also a kind of cultural immersion.
In the evening, we give them the cultural aspect of coming to the Cherokee Nation. They get to meet the chief. We go out to the Cherokee village that shows how our past ancestors lived. And we have different speakers come in. We have some storytelling. And it's just really a fun week as well as an educational week. But they're still not going to get the full benefit of the cultural aspect. So we're hating that they're going to miss that. But at least they're going to get the college portion.
Randall says normally the College Prep Institute would only accept up to 40 recipients. But because of the new online program, that number is expanding.
We're going to open it to 100 and hopefully fill them up, because, you know, since it is virtual, we want to reach as many students as possible.
The Cherokee College Prep Institute runs from July 19th through the 21st, and it's designed for Native students entering their junior or senior year of high school, with preference given to Cherokee Nation citizens. Applications are now open and will be accepted through July 5th. More information is available online at CherokeeNationFoundation.org. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Daniel Carruth.
In about 10 minutes on this edition of Ozarks at Large, the final episode in our podcast, The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas. The conclusion, just ahead on this Monday, Ozarks at Large. Today is the final day of early voting during a special election in Lowell. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has the details about what voters can expect to see on their ballot when they head to the polls.
Residents are being asked to approve the extension of an existing 1% sales tax. An extension of the tax was last supported by voters in 2011 and is set to expire January 1st of 2022. If approved, Lowell Mayor Chris Moore says the tax is expected to generate $2.5 million annually, and that funding will support infrastructure projects and city services.
In essence, 50% goes to general revenue, which means that that helps pay for city services such as police, fire, street, city admin, our animal shelter, building services. So, and then 50% is dedicated to just our street. We spend more than that, but it is restricted to just street improvements.
Among those infrastructure projects is the extension of McClure Avenue to Highway 265 to help alleviate traffic.
We're also looking at the Highway 264 Bellevue interchange, getting that completed. We have several drainage issues in Northwest in our community across Northwest Arkansas. I'm sure has quite a bit as well, but we've identified, especially with the recent flooding, some drainage issues that we need to address. So I have more projects than I have money, but you know, we are doing our best to try to address those projects.
The heavy rainfall Northwest Arkansas experienced in late April caused damage throughout the city that will impact the number of projects officials need to complete.
Well, of course, we lost the Public Creek Bridge. That will have to be replaced. We had some damage along 264 in the Weatherton subdivision, some damage along Cambridge, damage along Concord. So it was a significant event for us. We are still assessing the actual number damage-wise, how much it's going to cost to fix this. But it was a significant amount of rainfall. And unfortunately, I believe we lost two homes in the process that over in Weatherton that need to really fix this.
It's common for municipalities in the region to use a sales tax to help finance projects within their city. For example, residents in Bentonville and Elkins last month approved a 1% sales and use tax in their respective cities. The difference, however, is Bentonville and Elkins are using bonds to finance their projects, while Lowell is not.
We're smaller, so the money that we would pay in interest, especially on something like this, we do a pay-as-you-go. So we'll save up a little bit. The money that we would pay in interest, we actually keep. Therefore, we can do the projects, and we think we do them as over time versus all at once, and it makes better planning for us.
If approved, the 1% sales and use tax would be extended for 108 months or 9 years. Lowell residents can cast their ballot until 4:30 this afternoon at the Benton County Clerk's Office at its Bentonville location or its Rogers location. Tomorrow, Election Day, polls will be open from 7:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. at Lowell First Baptist Church. More information is available at vote.bentoncountyar.gov. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And more elections this spring in Arkansas. Tomorrow, across the state, voters can begin casting early ballots in school elections. Several districts in the region have issues and candidates on the ballots. And tomorrow, on Ozarks at Large, an executive emergency mask order first declared during the worst of the 2020 COVID-19 pandemic, recently lifted, has been outlawed by the Arkansas legislature. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich will have that report. And Ozarks' Antoinette Grajeda will deliver our regular monthly examination of COVID-19 cases and vaccinations with the people behind ArkansasCOVID.com. That's on a Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large, tomorrow at noon and 7 p.m. You can always find the most recent edition of Ozarks at Large at OzarksAtLarge.com. You can also ask your smart speaker to please play Ozarks at Large to hear the most recent edition of our show. And you can listen on your schedule at any time by subscribing to our free podcast version of the show that's available through all major podcast distributors.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Shiloh Museum groundskeeper Marty Powers demonstrates how to tap sugar maples and turn the sap into maple syrup in a pre-recorded program Saturday, March 20th at 10:30 a.m. on the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History's Facebook page and YouTube channel. This pre-recorded demonstration is part of the museum's Shiloh Saturday series for families. 750-8165 or shilohmuseum.org for more.
This is Ozarks at Large. We took some time off last week to air some archive pieces from our previous 31 years of shows. But judging from our email inbox, we appear to have been the only ones taking a quick breather. Here are just a few of the items that were announced in just the past few days. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith announced a nearly $8 million gift from the Wingate Foundation, which will provide multiple avenues to enrich and elevate academic opportunities for students at UAFS. The gift includes more than $4 million in direct student support through a need-based university scholarship, $394,000 for academic program development and expansions, $240,000 to develop an artist-in-residence program, and $120,000 to support paid internships for emerging student artists and designers. A Fayetteville organization dedicated to helping people experiencing long-term homelessness is receiving a $1 million gift from Jane Hunt. The gift will help New Beginnings with the completion of its capital project while providing critical financial support for sustained programming. The gift was organized with the help from the team at Arkansas Community Foundation. The Tyson Family Foundation is contributing $300,000 to the University of Arkansas to create the Tyson Digital Library Fund and the Tyson Art Publications Fund. Both funds will support the University of Arkansas Press in the Division of Research and Innovation. The UA Press intends to use the gift to digitize the entire collection of books, making them more widely available and accessible than ever before, and to advance the press's potential in the field of art publishing by supporting scholarship that explores the history and meaning of art and its effects on our lives. The primary for the Republican nomination for Arkansas Lieutenant Governor is a bit crowded this week. Doyle Webb, who was the head of the Arkansas Republican Party for 12 years, is seeking the nomination. He joins State Senator Jason Raypert and Arkansas Attorney General Greg Bledsoe in that race for Lieutenant Governor. As of today, Washington Regional will begin answering questions about the COVID-19 vaccine through its COVID-19 hotline. Dr. Mark Thomas, Vice President of Population Health of Washington Regional, says Washington Regional understands many people are waiting to get the vaccine because they have concerns or questions, and that there is a considerable amount of misleading and inaccurate information circulating about the vaccine, which makes it even more difficult for individuals to make a decision. Those who have vaccine questions can call the Washington Regional COVID-19 hotline at 479-463-2055. The hotline is available Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. until 2:30 p.m. There will be a medical professional on the other line. We'll give you that hotline number again at the end of this edition of Ozarks at Large. The hotline, which launched in March 2020, will also continue to offer general information about COVID-19, including providing screenings, testing information, and navigation services to individuals with suspected or confirmed cases of COVID-19. And earlier today, the Creative Arkansas Community Hub and Exchange, or CASH, announced the launch of a new artist residency space, CASH Studios. It's located at 1004 Southeast 5th Street in Bentonville. CASH Studios will be a collaborative shared space for Northwest Arkansas-based artists. And to celebrate this launch, CASH will host an inaugural art party on May 21st at the space with performances from several local artists and musicians. The art party will feature a combination of live stream and in-person art events for the ribbon-cutting ceremony of CASH Studios.
Louisiana is among the states setting aggressive climate goals. The longtime oil and gas state is now trying to figure out how to become carbon neutral by 2050.
And if anyone can identify innovative and sustainable solutions for our future, it is Louisiana. And our kids are counting on us.
I'm Elsa Chang. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered this afternoon from 3 to 6 on 91.3 KUAF. This is Ozarks at Large. Thanks for being with us on this Monday in May. Over the past several months, we have shared the episodes of the podcast The Movement That Never Was, A People's History of Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, with you here on our show. And today, we present the final installment. You can find the earlier episodes at KUAF.com. We have also conducted a series of public conversations over the past few months, each connected to topics in the individual episodes with some of the people who were included in each edition of the podcast. Those virtual conversations were conducted in cooperation with the Fayetteville Public Library and can be viewed in their entirety at the Fayetteville Public Library's YouTube channel. We'll have one more public conversation, again virtual and again with the aid of the Fayetteville Public Library, that will be associated with what we're about to hear. We'll have all the details for you about that very soon. Right now, though, here is the latest edition of The Movement That Never Was, A People's History of Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas.
The seeds of an anti-racist movement are scattered all over Arkansas. You can find them in small river towns and in mountain hollers and in rural public school auditoriums. Most of them are subtle, but that's kind of the point. Waving the banner of anti-racism won't fly in most of the rural South, so organizers are trying to start small. For this final episode of the series, let's focus on one big takeaway. All anti-racist organizing in the South or involving Southerners starts on a small scale, as sit-ins at ice cream parlors and lunch counters, or as voter education classes in the rural cotton belt, or as a hillbilly street gang turned tenants' rights group in Chicago. When we take a big sweeping look back at the history of anti-racism in the South, it's easy to lose track of the people who gave their energy to organizing in their hometown, in their neighborhood, in their church. But we won't know what's next for Arkansas, and for the South as a whole, and the country as a whole, unless we pay attention to the small stuff. From KUAF Public Radio, and with funding from the Winthrop Rockefeller Foundation, I'm Paul Kiefer, and this is The Movement That Never Was, A People's Guide to Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas. So let's end the series by getting to know the lay of the land. And we'll start big and zoom in from there. All over Arkansas, small community groups are embracing the idea of rural solidarity, usually poor and working class solidarity, as the path towards healthier rural communities. And within those groups, there are the building blocks for a rural anti-racist movement. And as it happens, there are also statewide networks that might help a movement like that take off. One of them is the Rural Communities Alliance, a political advocacy group made up of volunteers from small towns and rural counties across Arkansas. The Rural Communities Alliance mostly focuses on fighting against rural school closures. That's their bread and butter.
A school in a rural community is literally, you know, the heartbeat.
That's Candace Williams, the group's executive director. She's from Elaine in the Delta. They lost their school district to consolidation in 2006, and that prompted her to get involved in the Rural Communities Alliance. On its surface, fighting for the survival of rural public schools isn't inherently an anti-racist cause, but it's a cause that can get a broad coalition of people onto the same team and into the same room.
We have very conservative members. We have members that are liberal. We, you know, black, white, different parts of the state. And we were always able to work together around rural education issues.
And getting volunteers from rural white communities to join forces with rural communities of color has provided a window of opportunity to introduce some nuance into conversations about rural solidarity. That window got even bigger when the Rural Communities Alliance held its annual conference in Elaine in 2019, the 100th anniversary of the massacre that left lasting scars on the region's black community. Williams says that the conference involved a bus trip to the site where the massacre began, a black church burned to the ground by a white mob.
So many of our members, especially our white members, they said, Candace, we didn't even know this happened. Some of our members in the Southwest region, they came and said, we didn't know anything about this. So I feel like that laid the groundwork for our most recent efforts around this conversation, this very uncomfortable conversation of how race has played a part in the Delta looking like the Delta looks, you know, just being very frank and being so under-resourced and so poor.
But Williams says she still has to raise the subject of race delicately. Even if fighting for rural public schools creates a window of opportunity to bring up racial justice, there still isn't a clear path for her to bring anti-racism to the forefront of what the Rural Communities Alliance does.
We want just and thriving rural communities. And that has been what I use. I understand the dynamic of what the state is now, you know. So everything we did that I personally wanted to speak out against as an organization, I have not done that because we're in this position now where we have this very diverse membership. Don't want to like shut anybody out, but we don't want to be silent on things that we really need to have a voice on.
Thank you. That's the harsh reality for a lot of organizers in Arkansas trying to promote anti-racism. If they try to build a broad coalition by keeping their anti-racism subtle, they're still waiting for a chance to shift away from subtlety towards the start of a bona fide anti-racist movement. And that's true even when you zoom in closer. A coalition between two towns on the opposite sides of Arkansas can be a tricky thing to keep alive. A coalition between neighbors in a single rural town has the potential to be even more tricky. But that kind of pressurized environment is also a good testing ground for the longevity of a movement. And one of those testing grounds is on a quiet residential street near the Arkansas River in Dardanelle. It's called the McElroy House.
I wound up inheriting what had been my mom's parents' house, my grandparents' house, which I had pretty much grown up in. You know, I didn't want to rent it out. I didn't want to profit off of it or anything like that. I wanted to like figure out a way to make it into a community center and give back to the community. My grandparents had always been like super welcoming people, and there was always people in the living room when I was growing up and stuff like that. And
that's Meredith Martin Motes, a Dardanelle local, folklorist, and a former KUAF reporter who helped bring the McElroy House into being over the past decade. And she says that the point of the McElroy House is to help Dardanelle get to know itself better. Its past, its value, and how a community like Dardanelle, a small and relatively poor southern town, can band together to fix local problems. It's inspired by a similar project in a historical black neighborhood in western Kentucky. The goal is to rebuild a sense of community and identity. But Meredith is tackling that project in a town that's mostly white. So building an identity is a delicate task.
This is a place where there's a lot of white supremacist organizing. So like that is, you know, it wasn't too awfully long ago that we had literal Nazis march in Russellville, which is like one town over. So, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do is provide alternatives for people in the community. I think a lot of times white Southerners are sort of given like this one option. Like if you are, you know, love being from the South and you love your family, then you have to do this sort of trajectory of like pro-Confederacy. You know, I think that like we want to provide options for people that are not that's not the only path, or the other path is, well, I've got to move away to some other like big city, or I've got to move, you know, to some place that's super progressive or something like that. You know, like those are not the only two options. Like you don't have to wind up as a white supremacist or move.
But Dardanelle has changed in the past few decades. These days, notably, about 40% of the town is Latinx.
Rural America is not all white. And I think that's a really big myth.
And Meredith says that the goal of the McElroy House is to tie together all of Dardanelle, to help people feel an attachment to the place and to their neighbors.
So I think our big push is we're trying to carve out a space where there are a myriad of options for people to understand history and move forward, thinking about what makes this town equal for everyone, or not just town, but this whole region. And, you know, how do we love where we come from while at the same time being able to look it straight in the eye and understand exactly what the injustices and struggles are? Like, to be able to hold both of those things at the same time.
And she says that a lot of that work comes down to helping people understand where they're from. That can take a lot of forms. The house hosts community conversations and gardening workshops and skill sharing sessions about weatherizing houses. It has a really eclectic calendar.
The McElroy House a lot of times does, for lack of a better word, the kind of gritty, mundane work. It's not very flashy, typically.
But importantly, those mundane workshops get people from Dardanelle into the same room, or at least down on their knees next to each other in a garden. It doesn't always mean that people hold hands and sing kumbaya.
A lot of times people think that when we're like, we bring people together across difference and everything is just like happy and it's kittens and it's rainbows, and that is absolutely not what it's like. I mean, there have been a lot of discussions at the McElroy House that have been downright volatile and contentious.
But it's still a way to build a sense of solidarity in Dardanelle.
I've seen people learn what DACA even is. I've watched people be like, wait a minute, you came here when you were two, and now you can't go to school without out-of-state tuition, even though you graduated from our local high school with a 4.0 and you got a scholarship, but you can't use it because you're going to have to pay out-of-state tuition. But you're like, we're on the football team, and like, this is your hometown, but according to our laws, you're not really a citizen fully. I've seen people learn that information like firsthand in a conversation at the McRae House because people just literally didn't know it before.
And Meredith thinks that having a house near Front Street with an overflowing community garden that invites people from Dardanelle to be neighborly is, in an understated way, a kind of anti-racism. And a lot of that comes down to the McElroy House's role in making people feel hopeful about their town. Hope that Dardanelle can be a supportive place where people take pride in knowing and looking out for their neighbors. But a lot of this is aspirational. As long as the McElroy House has existed, it still hasn't managed to become the kind of gathering place that Meredith hopes it will be. But the longer the house exists, the more people in town see it as a chance to get some wheels turning. One of those people is Haroza Meza.
Well, I was actually born in Mexico, and I came here when I was 8, and I've been here ever since. I'm 24 now.
Haro has been showing up for conversations at the McElroy House for a while. For him, it's a point of hometown pride, and it isn't intimidating to step in the door.
They're kind of random chairs, kind of gives it a little bit of a more accommodating feeling, because it's nothing serious. It's nothing, it is serious. The topics are serious, but the setting isn't.
And Haro sees the McElroy House as a conduit to help families like his, families who immigrated to Dardanelle from Mexico and Central America in the past few decades, to set down roots in Dardanelle. And even on a basic logistical level, that's a tough task.
So normally you would get people that, like, for example, all these poultry factories that we have here that would work 12 to, if you allow them, they'll work 12 to 16 hour shifts. So a lot of them don't really have time to do any of the community activities. And if they do have time, they're usually, whenever they do have time, they're usually exhausted and would rather be at home with their families.
But as non-confrontational as the McElroy House may be, in a town that can be hostile to immigrants and a small town where stirring the pot can create big ripples, Haro's also had a hard time convincing other Latinx people in Dardanelle that getting involved in the McElroy House is a good idea.
To an extent, I feel like what they would rather do is just stay hidden, stay secluded, so that they're not a target. They don't want to be seen as a group of people that are causing trouble in the community, because they know that they're already in a kind of a bad situation as it is.
But Dardanelle is Haro's hometown. So to him, it's just a matter of trying over and over again. A cultural festival he organized with the McElroy House didn't pan out as he hoped, but when he told people at a community conversation that basic things like the town's trash pickup schedule weren't available in Spanish, he managed to cobble together enough support to fix the problem. But as much as the McElroy House is about building a hyper-local coalition, or a healthy rural town, or a sense of local pride, so that people like Haro can sort out fixes to local problems, Meredith says there's another real core goal to the project.
Like, a core goal of the McElroy House is, what do you build beyond whiteness?
In some ways, that's part and parcel with the goal of building a healthier town. The McElroy House can remind white people in town that collaborating with their neighbors produces a lot more good than embracing white nationalism.
A lot of the, white supremacist organizing is basically like playing on this idea that, like, what little power you have, they want to take it. And if you don't hold on and grow that power, you will become completely irrelevant and completely without a home. And, and the fact that you're already kind of poor and white trash, so to speak, you will even become more so. And so, it's this sort of question of, how do you not think in terms of everything you're going to lose, but the kind of like community that you're going to build.
But she says the McElroy House is also about building a sense of pride and identity for white people in Dardanelle. But not white pride. It's a different kind of pride, one that Meredith hopes can fuel an anti-racist movement.
I think that's one of the things that, like, a lot of organizing that's more progressive or left often really gets so horribly wrong is not understanding the importance of having you know, cultural identity around being proud of who you are and being proud of where you come from, and that you can hold that complexity of both saying, like, this part is horrible, we're not continuing to do that. Also, we are people who are, you know, insert whatever your regional, you know, strengths are, right? You have to have both of those things for people to feel alive.
For Meredith, and for a lot of other white people in Dardanelle, that means developing a sense of pride in being from rural Arkansas. She's talking about the more fundamental things that make a culture.
I absolutely love the culture I come from in a lot of ways. The, like, resilience and the gardening and the hunting and the rural life ways and, you know, the toughness and, like, I mean, all that stuff is incredibly important, I think, to our community identity. I think our job is to wrestle that stuff away from the racism that, you know, is part of that. Like, we have to be able to say, like, we can untangle these.
And to Meredith, the McElroy House gives her and other like-minded people in Dardanelle a chance to focus on the things from their culture that aren't about whiteness, that aren't imbued with white supremacy. And in Dardanelle, that means building pride in things, in quilting or in gardening or in self-sufficiency, that aren't exclusive to white people at all. The way she sees it, it's a chance to give people an identity that can outlast whiteness. Meredith says she doesn't want to see white people in Dardanelle forget their past, as ugly as it may be. But as she sees it, the point of getting to know the history of Dardanelle, and the point of getting to know the history of racism and classism and whiteness and everything else that shaped it, is to remember why families like hers were willing to keep racism alive, and then to figure out how people like her can avoid repeating the same mistakes.
Because I think sometimes, like, white people can get really hung up on erasing, denying, or being too ashamed of their past and their family, and that's really not functional at all. It doesn't move anything forward.
But Meredith knows that a community garden isn't the epitome of radical anti-racism. And she knows her optimism would seem out of place in most anti-racist circles. But she says that the McElroy House can make a bigger impact if it focuses on building a model for a healthy Dardanelle.
We're not very good poster children for the white anti-racist movement because we tend to be hyper, like, local. And because we'll often work across divisions that a lot of other people won't do, they want to be more radical and things like that. But for us, like, we feel very strongly about working within this community and being accountable to Black leaders in other communities, but working here, specifically here.
And she thinks that's the key to sticking around and shaping the future of Dardanelle.
A lot of people, you know, would say that the McElroy House is, like, too safe. And, you know, I would in some ways agree. I would also say that the McElroy House will not go away. It is consistent and it will remain consistent.
So what lays ahead for Southern anti-racism? In the end, a lot of it will come down to a question we touched on a few times in this series. The type of coalition building work that defines a lot of the anti-racist organizing in today's South is about convincing people, and especially white people, that anti-racism is in their best interest. But that creates a tricky threshold to cross. When anti-racist organizing requires white people to give something up, the model stumbles. but the aftermath of Freedom Summer in the mid-1960s is a case study about what happens when anti-racist organizing requires white people to be altruistic. Like SNCC organizer Michael Simmons said in our first episode, when the dust had settled after a few summers worth of voting rights campaigns, a lot of black SNCC volunteers like him wound up seeing white volunteers as an obstacle to real racial justice, not contributors to it. Instead, Michael said that he and his black colleagues wanted to see white civil rights activists turn their attention to white people, which leaves a big question unanswered. What will it take to reach a balance? Meredith put it a little differently.
How do you move something from fragility to foundation?
You can hear the previous episodes in our podcast series, The Movement That Never Was, A People's History of Anti-Racism in the South and Arkansas, by going to KUAF.com. And we will have another in our series of public conversations connected to the podcast series that will be conducted in cooperation with the Fayetteville Public Library. We'll have details about that next conversation for you soon so you can watch virtually and participate as well. Saturday, the Fayetteville Public Library will take part in a dedication and award ceremony connected to the unveiling of a marker commemorating the lynching and murder of Aaron, Anthony, and Randall, two black men and one black boy, age 15, in 1856. The actual marker will be unveiled Saturday morning at Oaks Cemetery in Fayetteville by the Washington County Remembrance Project. Then, Saturday afternoon at 12:30, there will be an award ceremony at the Fayetteville Public Library, sponsored by the Washington County Remembrance Project. The award ceremony is for the Equal Justice Initiative essay competition winners. This morning, we talked with Roanne Elliott with the Washington County Remembrance Project and Wendell Huggins, a member of the board of directors of the Oaks Cemetery, where that marker will be placed. We talked to them about Saturday's events and the murders more than 150 years ago. Much of that conversation will be on an edition of Ozarks at Large later this week. But we wanted to share today a bit of the history behind the marker. Roanne Elliott says there isn't much known about the men murdered by a white mob in 1856.
Because, of course, you know, they weren't considered important enough to do very much recording of their history. But what we do know is that they were owned by prominent citizens of the county, and they were accused of murder, and then there was actually a trial in which one of the men, Randall, was found guilty of murder on hearsay evidence and was refused a second trial, and the other two men were stolen from the jail and lynched by a mob that was led by two attorneys who were the sons of the man who was murdered. There is an oral history that tells a very different story about that the murdered man had been assaulting a slave woman and had been killed in a fight, or an encounter with her, but that's really all we know.
She says Saturday's events are designed for conversations about the past, the present, and future, and all of it begins with the official ceremony for the unveiling of the marker in Oak Cemetery at 10:15 Saturday morning.
That'll be just a really short, informal get together to give people an opportunity to see the marker. We'll have a pastor who will say a few words, and And that'll pretty much be it. It'll be a very quiet, informal kind of thing. And then later that afternoon at 12:30, we're going to gather at the Fayetteville Public Library for a program. And that will be an opportunity to talk about the memorial and to also honor the students who submitted essays to our racial justice essay contest. And we'll have representatives there from the Equal Justice Initiative, which is the organization in Montgomery, Alabama, who established the National Monument to Peace and Justice and the Legacy Museum. So we're just really excited that two people from that organization will be joining us to honor the students and to remember Aaron, Anthony, and Randall. And so there'll be, we have part of the youth choir from the St. James Baptist Church who will be joining us for that. We have a speaker who's a longtime resident of Fayetteville's Black community who will be speaking briefly, and also someone from the university who will be talking about racial trauma and, you know, resilience.
Roanne Elliott is with the Washington County Remembrance Project and talked with us this morning about Aaron, Anthony, and Randall, three Black people murdered by a white mob in Fayetteville in 1856. A marker dedicated to the three will be unveiled Saturday morning at 10:15 at Oaks Cemetery in Fayetteville. It is open to the public. We also talked with Wendell Huggins, who is on the board of the Oaks Cemetery and a longtime Fayetteville resident. We'll hear from him and more from Roanne Elliott on an Ozarks at Large taking place later this week on 91.3 KUAF.
KUAF is supported by Little Guys Movers, built on family values and community involvement for over 28 years. Little Guys Movers focused on changing the image of the moving industry, one move at a time. LittleGuys.com for more information. Tickets are now available for singer-songwriter Melissa Etheridge coming to the Walton Arts Center on Sunday, October 10th. This Grammy Award winner produced hits such as I'm the Only One, Come to My Window, Bring Me Some Water, and more. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets.
We're getting to that time of year when we start talking about postseason tournaments for baseball and softball. The Arkansas softball team will begin play in the SEC tournament Thursday afternoon, meeting the winner of a previous Texas A&M Tennessee game. Arkansas will go into the tournament as the number two seed. They tied for the best season record in the SEC with Florida. Florida and Arkansas did not meet face-to-face this year, so the tiebreaker for the number one seed was determined by how each team did against the number three finisher, Alabama. Florida took 2 of 3 from the Crimson Tide. Arkansas lost 2 of 3, therefore Arkansas is the number two seed in that single elimination tournament. Number one Arkansas baseball Razorbacks will play their last non-conference game of the regular season tomorrow night at Baum Stadium in Fayetteville, hosting Arkansas State University. After that, it's 3 games at Tennessee this weekend, then 3 games against Florida the following weekend at Baum Stadium. Arkansas is currently the top team in the SEC West. Tennessee, the opponent in Knoxville this weekend, currently stands at the top of the SEC standing. Should be a good series in Knoxville this weekend. The number 17 Arkansas women's golf team has started its NCAA tournament journey. They began play this morning at the Louisville Regional. They'll be there through Wednesday. The Razorback soccer team season ended last week while we were away in the NCAA round of Sweet 16. Arkansas was shut out by Santa Clara 2-0. It was the second ever trip to the Sweet 16 in Arkansas soccer history. The Northwest Arkansas Naturals were rained out of their game against the Arkansas Travelers in North Little Rock yesterday. Now have a day off, and then we'll open the home season at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale tomorrow night against Tulsa. It's the start of a 6-game homestand in Springdale. The Naturals have started the season 3-2. By the way, all Mondays are off days this year for the Northwest Arkansas Naturals and all of the other teams in the AA Central North Minor League.
Are there diamonds in meteorites? I'm Caitlin Ahrens, the Pluto manager, and this is Scratching the Surface. Diamonds, the solid form of the element carbon, are fairly rare on Earth, but surprisingly very common in space, particularly in meteorites. Though not necessarily gem quality to any stretch of the imagination. So how are diamonds in space formed? It all comes down to the amount of carbon, where a bulk of the carbon in our solar system comes from our sun. There are also high-pressure diamonds that also form in the carbon and methane molecules on the ice giants of Uranus and Neptune. But diamonds and meteorites were discovered in 1987, where grains of about 2.5 nanometers of solid carbon diamond were found. Trapped in the diamonds were noble gases, indicating these diamonds were not from Earth and possibly not from our recent solar system. That means these probably formed from the ejected carbon and dust and gas of a star that then got conglomerated through the formation of the solar system, only to break and land on the Earth as a meteorite. Large diamonds have been found in the meteorite Almahada Sita, found in the Nubian Desert in Sudan. This was the very first meteorite to find diamonds with mixtures of iron and sulfur minerals. And these crystals are dated at 4.5 billion years old. For more segments of Scratching the Surface, visit KUAF.com.
The KUAF Pluto manager, Dr. Caitlin Ahrens, studied space and planetary sciences at the U of A. She's currently a postdoctoral researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland. Scratching the Surface is a production of KUAF Public Radio in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
This is Ozarks at Large, and before we end today's show, let's again give you the COVID-19 hotline from Washington Regional beginning today, answering any questions you have about the vaccines themselves. That hotline, 479-463-2055. You can also ask about vaccine appointments and other matters related to COVID-19. It is being operated Monday through Friday from 8 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon. This is 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Cave Springs. 91.3 KUAF is a listener-supported service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. Contributors to our show today included Daniel Carruth and Antoinette Grajeda. Our show produced by Timothy Dennis, socially distanced next door in the Harold and Blanchcock News Studio. Our big thanks to Lee Wood and everybody with the Movement That Never Was podcast team. Again, you can hear previous editions of that podcast by going to KUAF.com. Additional content today provided by our colleagues at KUAR, Public Radio for Little Rock and Central Arkansas. Scratching the Surface is written and hosted by Dr. Caitlin Ahrens, and it is produced by Pete Hartman in the Nancy Blair Operations Studio at KUAF. Our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. You can often find Daryl around 4 o'clock hour time performing live and sometimes taking requests on his Facebook and Instagram feeds. You can find out more about his music at darylsean.com. We'll be back with you tomorrow at noon and 7 for a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. Thanks so much for being with us. Please take care of yourself. Get rest when you can. We do appreciate you making us part of your day. I'm Kyle Kellums. Talk to you again soon.